Gemini podcast, my lovely little astro babes. I am Shade the Mad, daughter of Mercury and the Gemini part of this podcast. With me, as always, is my lovely co-host, Alice Alistair. Hi, Alice.
Hello, Shade.
How are you today?
Very, very excited. We get to talk about one of my favorite pieces of music ever.
Yeah, I could tell that when I went ahead and gave, like, the green light on this little project of yours that you were just, like, vibrating out of your chair to do it. And, you know, I can't say, like, I have even found myself getting the urge to listen to the planets just for shits and giggles at this point. There are certain, like, bits and phrases from certain movements that have gotten thoroughly, like, lodged in my brain. And, you know, it's an earworm. Sometimes you just gotta put it on and listen to it and get it out of your system, you know?
Yeah, it's no 3-minute pop song, but it does have some pretty strong pop power, I'd argue.
Well, not only that, but I feel like there are things, like, I've not listened to it enough to know everything about each piece by any means. So every time I listen to it, I hear more going on, or I hear different things that I like about it. I like that ability to kind of keep peeling away layers upon layers and discovering new things, even if it's not necessarily like a big deal, you know, it's still fun to, it's part of the fun of classical music, I think.
Absolutely.
So, if you didn't already know, we are going to be talking about Gustav Holst's The Planets today, and I'm gonna just kind of let Alice take it away, but before I do, I just wanted to ask you got to actually play this piece for realsies, didn't you?
Yeah, yes, once.
Tell us a little bit about that setting, because I actually didn't know that until we started, like, discussing more in detail, kind of some of the musical things, the technical things that are happening that you had actually experienced playing this piece yourself.
Yeah, it was, when I went to music school, for a little while, almost a decade ago. And it was with the Lamont Symphony Orchestra, and so the long and short of it is that it was a very fulfilling experience getting to play the planets and getting to just, like, feel that, like, raw energy of each of them, especially at a time when I was basically just getting into astrology pretty seriously, and so all of the kind of astro backdrop of what the planets meant was just, like, really starting to speak for the first time in the experience of playing the damn thing. And I was and am still not a classical bass player, and so I was just sitting there way back in last chair, because, like, yeah, no, I was a jazz student, and the orchestra was on fire compared to, you know, other experiences. Like, it felt like being in an honor band. But, you know, there are pros to being maybe not the best player in a section where people aren't necessarily going to hear you otherwise, and you can just kind of let it go and appreciate how awesome everybody else sounds.
Yeah, you can kind of, you don't have to take it as seriously when you're in last chair as opposed to being in first chair or second chair. I get that. Yep. Yeah. So the orchestra that you were part of, was it anywhere near as big as Holst, like, composed this for? Like, because it's a giant orchestra that is kind of required to play this piece. It is a giant orchestra that is required. The sections are, like, way larger than a lot of what was happening, you know, with other composers at the time. So how did that compare for you guys? Were you guys just kind of like making do where you could, or did you have a large enough ensemble to give it the life that it deserved?
Yeah, I, to the best of my knowledge, we did. You know, it's like we weren't way out in like Adam State or something like that. Like, so there was no shortage of players, and we had, you know, guest appearances for the Celesta part. We had multiple harps. Yeah, it's wow. It felt pretty grand.
And did you guys have the choir?
Oh fuck yeah, yes. Nice. Okay, yeah, that was probably the moment that was just extra visceral. Like, it was all really visceral, but like playing Neptune and definitely playing it on a sleep deprived performance. You know, if I'm sleep deprived, then I get emotional very quickly. And just sitting there listening to the choir doing its thing, and no spoilers yet. We'll talk about it when we get to Neptune, but it's just like hearing it and realizing what was happening was like, oh my God, I'm chilled to the bone. I need to go cry.
Wow. That's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. I can honestly say that, having that feeling of being part of like something beautiful like that, that, you know, an ensemble that makes music together and everybody has their part and it's all just so important. I mean, it's just, there's nothing like it. There's no other feeling that compares to being part of an orchestra or a symphony or a big band or even just being part of like a quartet or anything like that is, you know, feels amazing. But there is just something special about large bands and being a part of one and doing large pieces of classical music like this one.
Yeah.
it's magic. It is pure magic. Everybody should do whatever they can to experience something similar at least once in their lifetime.
Yeah.
Even if you're just the dope ass, you know, like tambourine player, they're important too.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. The planets, a couple of those movements definitely make use of tambourine and it would not be the same without it.
I'm telling you. So without further ado, let us talk about Gustav Holst and how we came to know the planets.
Yeah. So, this is just some little fun facts, because there is a decent amount of mystery surrounding the composition of the planets, at least according to my research. And a lot of this is coming from Richard Green's book about the planets, I believe. But basically, we got Gustav Holst. He's an English composer who was born September 21st, 1874. And he primarily worked as a school teacher. He worked at a girls' school and I believe Morley College, doing choir directing, as well as performing on the side as a trombonist and an organist. And then in his in-between time, he would write. And so he wrote a lot of music for, I mean, choirs, wind bands. There's some really, like, standard repertoire from Holst in wind band, like the first suite and the second suite. So Holst was not fresh to the world of composition or writing large-scale works by the time that he started working on the planets. You know, his pieces were being performed around England a decent amount by 1914, which was when we think he started writing the planets. Green notes that there aren't really, like, sketches or things like that that show us the process. It's kind of like the planets just sprang up out of nowhere one day, basically. And, you know, logistically, if you're working as a school teacher and gigging on the side and all of that, like, that probably was not the case. having Like, having time to do his thing was a big part of Holst's, like, life at that point, because he was very busy just trying to make enough money to survive as a musician and earn enough time on the side to be able to write, which, you know, that's pretty fucking relatable as somebody who's trying to do a similar thing.
Sure, yeah. There's never enough time in the day.
God, no, there is not.
It's for creative types, there is never enough time in the day.
Yeah, so all of that is to say, you know, if that impassioned musing upon the power of playing in a big ensemble wasn't enough to make you think, oh, maybe I should do what I can to make sure the arts get funded and that there's music in schools and that kids have access to instruments and music teachers and all of that, I'm telling you now, you should consider that an important thing. I mean, while we were researching, or while we were planning out this episode, we took some time to listen to a recording of The Planets Together, and the first one we stumbled on was very obviously a student recording.
Yes.
And it just brings, you know, it brings me back to this experience I had in Honor Bands where the director was like, everybody pick one note to play wrong, just one, and we're going to play this passage of music and see how noticeable it is if everybody just misses one note. And lo and behold, it was extremely noticeable.
Yes, of course, yeah.
So, yeah, music is one of those things.
Even to the untrained ear, it would be hella noticeable.
Yeah, and, you know, it takes a lot of time and practice, especially if you play an instrument like a brass, like if you play a French horn or something like that. Like, if you play a string instrument, you gotta get your intonation right. Like, yeah. Anyhow. By 1914, this is when some of the sources suggest that Holst started writing Mars. Either way, it's important to realize that Holst was influenced by Alan Leo in particular, and before the summer of 1914, he might not have really been that aware of astrology. He had Holst was a very, like, mystically inclined person and took spirituality pretty seriously, so it wouldn't be outside of the realm of possibility, but there's just not a lot of evidence that says one way or the other that, you know, Holst definitely was doing astrology before this. After that point, he did read people's charts from time to time, and if you're looking at even the subtitles of each of the pieces, you know, like The Bringer of War, The Winged Messenger, stuff like that, bringing that back to Alan Leo, the astrologer, there's a book called What is a Horoscope and How is it Cast? And it was one of those books at the turn of the 19th into the 20th century that started bringing modern psychologized astrology into the world, basically. Wow. Holst probably took some inspiration from that, but at the same time, again, looking at the subtitles of each of the pieces, some of them line up with what Alan Leo wrote in that book, some of them don't, so it seems like Holst kind of had his own feeling for how he understood the planets and the kind of, like, character he was trying to portray with them. And ultimately, that is what Holst, like, described the planets as, like a series of quote-unquote mood pictures. So there's not, like, a story baked into each of the movements. Like, we can, as we start listening to some of these excerpts with you, we'll definitely be throwing imagery around, but this is all coming from our minds and our understanding of astrology and whatever else. This isn't necessarily what Holst intended. At the same time, it's like, if you know anything about the flavors of the planets, and you can just listen to the music and it speaks really clearly.
Yeah, I had a really difficult time at first just listening to these movements without imagining a scene playing out, or without, like, I almost would have preferred to blind listen to them without knowing like, maybe knowing what planet it was, but without knowing, like, the subtitle for each one. You know, because it just would have been kind of a fun experience to intuitively feel what was trying to be portrayed versus, like, here's, you know, it's like judging a book by its cover. Like, you know, you get, you're handed a song or a piece of music that says Mars, the bringer of war, and it kind of paints a picture of what you can expect from this piece. And then you hear the piece and it definitely just, like, it's like being handed a coloring page and now the music is just filling in all the colors for you. So, you know, I say that just to kind of point out that, like, the more you listen to it, the easier it gets to start just listening to the music for what it is and not necessarily, like, trying to fit it into the box of what it's titled in, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. And that's... it's worth noting that today we're just going to be listening to little excerpts from each of the movements, and, you know, music is not really made to be experienced that way, so we highly encourage you to sit down and, you know, listen to each of these things in their entirety, because, you know, with music, like, it's like any other kind of time-based media, you know, you can't really skip around without missing parts, necessarily. It's like going through the whole progression that gives you the development and the changes from the first time this or that melodic idea happened, and then the next time it happens, and what might be being said this time, you know?
Sure. All right, so are we jumping into Mars?
Yeah, so without further ado, let's listen to some music. Yeah, there's some drama from the outset.
Yes. I loved learning about this technique that the strings are using, where they are, like, instead of using the horsehair side of their bows, they're using the back of their bows and striking the strings with the wood part. Mm-hmm. It's just, like, a really great, unique sound, like, right out of the gate. And just tension. Tension, tension, tension.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, for the music geeks, this piece is in 5/4. So right off the bat, there's that kind of, like, snare drum and back of the bow kind of rhythm going on that's kind of, almost like a military march kind of feel, maybe, but it's not just a straight ahead, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 march. It's already kind of like uneven, and harmonically speaking, we got some dissonant intervals right off the bat. We're just kind of alternating between these two kind of like crunchy chords.
Right. Yeah, the 5/4 time signature thing was one of those, like, technically based or, like, technical based things that I had made note of too, where it's like, even for people who don't necessarily have, like, much background in music or reading music, you know, like, everybody does, like, little music lessons or whatever in elementary school. Surely you must remember your music teacher counting in 4/4 time, you know. Having the time signature in 5/4 feels weird. It feels unnatural and, like, automatically puts you on edge or, like, something's off. Sort of, like, sows the seed of distrust or something right away.
Yeah. Yeah, and this whole little intro section is just like, even if we didn't know it was subtitled The Bringer of War, or even that it was Mars necessarily, we know something's about to go down, and it sounds like it's going to be spicy.
Yes. Yeah, it definitely has that. It's going somewhere. There's movement there. We headed somewhere, and it doesn't sound friendly.
Ooh, let's find out where we're going.
Okay.
Yeah, so, feels like we just upped the ante quite a bit.
Yeah, we slipped right into a Star Wars film.
Yeah. Yeah, that big brass sound, and it feels very much like we're about to go into a space battle, or any sort of battle.
Yeah. I love that, like, full, round, brass sound that's coming out, and like you have these little snippets of like fanfares that make it feel that much more like a military piece. I don't know well enough to like be able to point out exactly the parts that are playing the fanfare necessarily, but they're there, and that's whew. Yeah, we get this whole piece is, I keep saying it, but it's like a lot of tension and very little release.
So far we've had these themes of tension and escalating drama and little moments in between these more dissonant harmonies where there's like these more kind of like almost valiant sounding themes that pop up in the brass that sound like, oh, whether or not there is a protagonist in this mood picture, there's definitely a sense of, like, I don't know if this is going to be a conflict that ends well, and then moments that are like, oh, no, we got this, like, charge!
Yeah, but there's some heroic qualities in there. You just... It's definitely, like, that sort of battle between can you overcome your fear and be the hero, because the fear is going to be there regardless, or are you going to rise up to meet the challenge or whatever. There is that sense about it.
Yeah. Yep. Nailed it. All right. Let's listen to some more Mars.
Let's do it. Talk about ominous. At least at the end there. You know, the beginning of that clip kind of reminds me of the theme that they play for the Wicked Witch of the West in The Wizard of Oz.
That's interesting. Yep. Yeah. God damn it.
Which is fine, because, you know, there is some, you know, duality in this piece in terms of, like, the, you know, forces of good and forces of evil, or, you know, there is a clearly something nefarious happening, and what is the Wicked Witch of the West, if not nefarious?
Yeah, yep, there's some sort of menace, some sort of foe afoot. and yeah, it felt like we started off kind of in that overcoming the fear kind of mindset a little bit, and then very quickly it was like that energy's ramped up and ramped up and ramped up until, ooh, that one long dramatic chord before things got quiet and kind of like, well, shit just got real. Maybe we should be a little bit more sneaky about whatever's going to happen next.
Yeah. Yeah, again, in that, like, last little bit, after it gets quiet, we sort of reestablish that military feel again with that little snare in the background still driving things forward.
Yeah, slight variation this time, which is, again, the fun of getting to explore these pieces that have such kind of well extrapolated themes. Like, that's one of Holst's strengths as a composer, in my opinion, is, you know, getting to take just a little chunk of music and do a bunch of different things with it. Like, once that march snare comes back in, this time it doesn't keep the straight up 5-4 pattern. Like, it leaves little breaks, and so yeah, that kind of just lends itself to that quality of like, ooh, caution. Whatever happened a few seconds ago, let's not repeat that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I like that.
And so I think we have at least one more clip. Let's find out.
Oh man, if there is one thing that timpani is good for, it's for either starting things or ending things.
Amen to that. Yeah, so that was the end of the piece. We kind of just skipped a lot of the recapitulations and kind of subtle back and forths of the main themes. But yeah, towards the end there, it's like the point is driven very, very, very home that whatever, like, the conflict has ended. And it sounds like it might have been a bit of a grim ending there.
It didn't sound happy. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's it feels like there was a very good fight that was fought in this phase, like this mood. And despite all of that, you know, it's like, you know, if we're thinking predator prey, maybe you were just inches away from getting out of the swamp before the alligator got you. But, oh, it got you. And chomps down real hard about four different times to let you know, nope, you're not getting out.
Oh, wow, that's a lot more bleak than I was thinking, but I mean, I do like the predator-prey analogy there, or like comparison, but I don't know. I guess I just have this, you know, all the things we've talked about in terms of Aries and Mars and like the vibes that they both give off respectively in terms of like traits and things that they relate to with this piece. This one I feel like is maybe one of the easier ones to really pinpoint, maybe because, you know, we kind of mentioned it before how like Aries tends to feel really basic in terms of what it relates to and what it can represent and all of that. You know, maybe that's why it feels more easily relatable in this particular piece of music. You know, you have somebody who's strong-willed, brave, heroic, maybe impulsive, you know, ready to fight the good fight or do battle or whatever. Those are all really intense but temporary feelings, you know, in the moment when you need them, I guess. And then that moment is gone, and you feel that, like, the slow regression of adrenaline or whatever, that, you know, the adrenaline drains or whatever, and I feel like that's kind of what's, like, that feeling is not a comfortable one when, like, your adrenaline has been pumping and, like, you know, your heart is racing and your breathing is, like, fired up and, you know, maybe you're, like, you know, sweating or you're, you know, flushed or whatever. Coming down from that is not always a comfortable experience. Just like coming down from this piece of music, this movement is not necessarily going to be a comfortable experience either. Until we get to the next movement.
Yeah. A little cosmic Valium for us.
Yes.
So without further ado, welcome to Venus. And maybe wherever that conflict or that action ended in the last movements, where might we go next when we introduce a new mood, a new archetype?
We are in stark contrast, I would say.
Yeah. thanks, AC. It's getting a little toasty in there.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of, I don't know, there's a lot of reassurance in Venus. There's a lot of predictability, where, like, Mars was all about building up that tension, and you didn't quite know where it was heading or where it was going to end. Venus just starts off right off the bat with this pattern that becomes very predictable. You know where it's heading, and it's resolved really quickly. So it sort of builds that trust with the listener over and over again for where we know this piece is. We know at least, at the very least, that it's not headed anywhere scary, like with with Mars.
Yeah. Yeah, already for contrasting the musical elements, Mars starts out with such a decisive, like, energy to it, and once it's started, it just keeps going, and, you know, when it chills out, it's really, really noticeable, because that's a big difference. With Venus, it's like there's this kind of symmetry right off the bat. Like, you've got this ascending, almost kind of like wistful horn line, and then it's met with the descending from the flutes, and just that kind of like asking a question, getting an answer kind of thing. It feels like this opening motif is very much like asking a question, and that feels pretty darn Venus. I mean, that could be a, hey, do you like me? but hey, do you like me though? Because again, yeah, this question just keeps coming up again and again throughout the piece.
Yeah. Yeah, this piece is like, I guess maybe like on a fundamental level, just much more simple than Mars was. It is much more simple, much clearer. It doesn't use anywhere near the amount of instruments or parts that Mars used, which I think, you know, it gives it more of like an intimate feel, kind of a quieter, slower, just more easygoing feel versus like this whole ass room that's full of people that Mars has us, you know, meeting with.
Yeah, definitely. Let's listen further. And yeah, that's about as intense as this one gets.
I was going to say, yeah, this might have actually been one of those moments when we did our listening little session together where I sort of thought that Venus has somewhat of a like an underlying sinister quality to it. Like maybe it's just, I don't know, like, things are just kind of burning a little too brightly, a little, you know, like, where it's sort of like that moment, like, when you're being pulled into a cult, and they're just, like, showering you with love, and that's all you see, is, like, bright light, and, you know, white robes, and just love everywhere, and then before you know it, the cups of Kool-Aid start to come out, and you're just too far in, you know, that's kind of the, like, I don't know if I, too much of a good thing, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, maybe that's a little bit of Venus's potentially seductive qualities. You know, it's like, it's interesting looking at Venus as an archetype of beauty and things that are soothing, and also knowing that, yeah, like, seduction is a thing that, you know, it can feel good sometimes. Other times it feels a little bit more sinister, and maybe you know it, maybe you don't know it.
Yeah, stay away from the sirens in the sea.
And the Venus fly traps on the land.
Yeah. Yeah. But
so yeah, that's that is to say, this one does, I mean, maybe it is a deceptive ending, but this one feels like it ends a bit more, I guess, resolved than Mars did. So I think let's listen ahead again, and we'll kind of hear, we'll hear that vibe, and also maybe hear how some of the earlier themes are being reinterpreted in a different way for this chunk.
So certainly, you know, we've certainly moved away from, like, sort of that menacing, sinister quality, which is good for this piece, because I think, you know, as far as I can tell, Holst did not really intend for Venus to really be sinister or anything. That seduction quality, or, like, that seduction aspect of it does come through, but it's not where Venus stays. It's not where Venus ends. I sort of like that at a certain point, this piece starts to feel a little bit like a lullaby. So this is the first time that we really start to hear the celesta in this whole suite, right?
Yeah.
And I did not know until I was learning about this piece that the celesta is the instrument that they play the Harry Potter theme on, like at the very beginning. That's the same instrument, the celesta.
Oh, yeah. It's, you can do some things with these little belly sounding things. I mean, it can sound a little bit more, well, I mean, either way, it's like, if it sounds like a lullaby or if it sounds a little bit more like magic, there's still kind of like something that's not quite normal waking consciousness happening, maybe.
Yeah, it's a really, really gorgeous, like, dreamy, starry sound for sure. But it looks kind of like a piano or something, right? Like a little organ or like a little keyboard. Not a keyboard, but like a harpsichord, maybe? I don't
know. Yeah. It's basically like a miniature version of an upright piano.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like, at least.
Right, yeah. And that's how it's played, too, basically. Not like like, what is that, like a dulcimer, where you hit it with like the little wooden hammer spoons.
Yeah, not quite as folksy.
But yeah, I mean, so we have this like really beautiful sounding instrument that kind of comes through and resolves some of that underlying tension that we were feeling before. This whole last portion of Venus has always felt like Venus is just kind of asking us to trust the process, to, you know, just allow that, like, metamorphosis to happen and trust that on the other side is something beautiful. And, you know, just kind of like, again, that reassuring quality that everything's going to be okay, I think, sort of, that's the vibe, the feeling that I get from this piece. So, like, we have these really heavenly sounding instruments that kind of, you know, wrap up Venus in a neat, pretty little bow with the harps and the celesta, and just, like, leaves us on a really positive, uplifting, quiet note, right?
Yeah. Which means it's time to switch gears.
Woohoo!
So yeah, buckle up for a different kind of contrast with this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, welcome to Mercury.
It is Mercury, the winged messenger and god of communication, which is, I think, the biggest theme that I got out of this entire piece. Not necessarily in this exact snippet, but there's a lot going on in Mercury. I cannot even begin to imagine what it was like to play this piece live.
Luckily, there isn't a whole lot going on in the bass part, so this was one where it's mostly like, oh, get to watch everybody else playing real fast.
And not just that, but, like, we have multiple keys going on at the same time. We have multiple time signatures going on at the same time, which to me just, like, so, like, literally illustrates Mercury's and, like, the, you know, Mercury being the ruling planet of, like, Gemini and Virgo. Master multitaskers. So it just is like this stunning example of how, you know, easily and comfortably multiple things can take place at one time when under Mercury's influence.
Yeah, extremely dexterous. I mean, it feels like, literally speaking, all these little melodic chunks are just kind of getting thrown around the orchestra, and so for just a few, you know, 16th notes, it'll be in one section, and then it gets passed on to, like, the next section along. And as it's alternating between the couple chords that it's doing, the kind of, like, multiple time signatures being pitted against each other, even at the most chaotic moments, it's like, it feels like if that was, somebody, you know, tripping and losing their step for a second, boom, they're right back on immediately afterwards. So also, it doesn't feel sloppy, even at its potentially most chaotic. It feels very like, oh, I know where I'm going. Mind your step here. Watch out for that low-hanging awning there. Like, but all of these warnings happening like...
Yeah, I love that. That is big Gemini energy right there.
It's also interesting... when I'm hearing this one nowadays, thinking about that kind of like like the conspiracy board kind of like thought cycle that can be, you know, Mercury signature sometimes, where it's just like, you know, one thought can lead to another, and quickly you're making connections between things that may or may not actually connect in the end. But it's almost like that's kind of what's happening all of that first section up until that new theme comes in and things kind of slow down just a little bit. And it's like, instead of just going one of the next, one of the next, one of the next, this new melody pops up and just like, oh, we got to repeat it a couple times before it starts making its way around. It's like, oh, this is an unfamiliar thought. Or like, you know, maybe you're reading some really difficult to pronounce word and you got to like sit with it for a while and be like, what? okay. Gonna practice this a few times.
Yeah, I love that. When you said conspiracy board, you're talking about like, you know, Charlie and the meme with like looking crazy, like pointing at the wall behind him. And it's just like papers with like red string tied between each thing.
Bingo.
That is, yeah, that is. I love that. I do love that kind of energy. And yeah, there's that, like, there's a lot of not just the multitasking aspect of this piece, but the communication aspect, where like sections are literally communicating between one another this melody that's kind of bouncing around. And when it does make that like sudden shift, we're, you know, sort of like, oh, what's, something's different. What happened? And none of it feels any slower necessarily. Like we're still being asked to stay quick-witted with it, but this piece is definitely a like blink and you'll miss it sort of, you know, piece. It has a lot of those moments, those elements to it.
Absolutely. Let's hear a little bit more. So, yeah, that's, we pick back up where we left off with this kind of new melodic theme happening, and for me it hits kind of like, again, we're kind of trying out this new thought or this new word or whatever, and, you know, it's like the more this theme starts getting repeated, it feels like there's this sudden rush of, like, Eureka, I've got it! At one point in there when, like, it really hits the loud points, and then, before you know it, whatever that insight was, whatever that realization was, it's back on the highway, and don't miss any exits, because if you do, you're fucked.
Yeah, there's that communication aspect again, where it's like, I sort of see it two ways, where like there's that communication aspect where once again a message has been sent. And one section is communicating that to the next section, and then that section communicates it to the next one, and so on and so forth. So it's kind of like this, it's like a ripple effect, where, yeah, you know, like raindrops on a puddle or something, where, you know, you're, the message is being heard and sent in multiple places all at once, and yet it stays clear the whole time. You know, like, we're like, ripples are never going to be, we're never going to turn into any other shape other than a circle as they radiate out, right? It's not like they change, you know, into squares or whatever the further out they get. It's not like that, you know, the rumor game or whatever, or...
I was going to say, this is higher fidelity than your elementary school attempt at playing telephone.
Yes, exactly, telephone, yeah. Yeah. You know, I just love that. I love that amount of energy. I love that communication stays clear and concise throughout the entire piece. It never gets garbled, maybe distracted, but never garbled.
I like that. That is totally accurate in pointing that out. I like that a lot.
I also just, like, want to point out how, and we'll see this almost immediately as soon as we start heading into the larger planets, Jupiter and Saturn, and that everything in this piece, to me, feels small. Even though it's happening quickly, everything is small, you know, where, like, Mars had these really, like, bold, round, brass sounds. Everything in this, in Mercury, is just played, like, at the top of people's instruments, at the tips of their fingers. Like, I mean, there can't be that many, for the string instruments, you know, there can't be many instances in Mercury where they're doing, like, long, drawn-out notes with their whole bow and their whole arm or anything, you know. There's, everything's, I'm sure, is, like, within one little tiny portion of their their bow. Everything just feels tiny comparatively to some of the other movements that we're about to get into.
Which makes a great setup for the contrast of the next one.
Jupiter, the bringer of jollity.
Right. Yeah, talk about obscure words people don't be using.
I know, you could have just said joy. I don't know, maybe not joy. I guess joy is kind of like, I don't know, to Santa Claus. But, you know, that sort of fits the vibe here, too, if you take out all the Christmassy chimes and bells and horse sleigh sounds.
True.
I bet Jupiter has a nice, you know, big belly laugh.
Santa Claus is definitely a Jupiterian figure if we wanted to give him astrological significance.
See? I kind of know what I'm talking about when it comes to this stuff.
So yeah, right off the bat, this stuff is, like, fast, but also significantly heavier than Mercury. Like, it's almost like, you know, that beginning string thing that happens, that little repeated section of three that turns into this kind of hemiola, just the did-it-did-it-did-it-did-it-did-it. That feels frantic. That almost feels more frantic than Mercury did to me, where it's just like, oh, shit. Go!
Yeah, I can see that. How do you think that that relates to, like, the vibes that Jupiter gives off? That, like, you know, that tension, that urgency?
Yeah, I mean, this whole beginning section to me feels like there aren't really many, like, well, this whole beginning section feels like there are a bunch of small arrivals, and they're all pretty dramatic. It's like we get a big cymbal crash or a big arrival in some really, you know, like, lush chord, but then not more than a couple seconds later, it's like, bring those gears back in, we're heading in a different direction, switch up the harmony a little bit, and that happens several times, where it's like, that feels like a little bit of that Sagittarian quality, the you know, the roaming of the centaur's arrow, where it's just like, okay, you know, there's never an end, there's never a done point, it's just like, okay, I'm bored, on to the next thing! Oh, I'm bored again. What else is going on?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I like that. We, like, in this clip, we haven't even really gotten to the truly fun parts of this movement yet. Things certainly feel bigger and larger than Mercury. We have those great big round brass sounds that I like again. And I think as this piece continues, we'll start to see more of what I really like about Jupiter, in that it starts to really pile on the layers. In, you know, I love sort of like dissecting that and peeling that apart, or like at least seeing the layers build. As much as you can see music. Yeah. We're talking about like a little synesthesia action or whatever.
Hell yeah. All right. Next chunk. Some layers there.
Okay, guess which one is my favorite.
Was it the tambourine?
No, surprisingly it was not.
What was it?
The timpani.
Oh, duh.
It does such a great job in really bolstering that large feel. They are playing the melody on the timpani.
Yes. Hell yes.
That's amazing. How often, I can't imagine that there are like a whole plethora of classical music pieces out there that play the melody on the timpani.
Right.
They certainly, I'm sure they certainly, you know, they feature prominently in a lot of pieces, but to play the melody.
Yeah.
I just love it.
Fun times in the percussion section.
Yeah. This is one of those, like, moments where when we get into, like, that big melody, it feels like a parade, and the title of the piece starts to make a lot more sense, because everybody loves a parade. I mean, you know, and it reminds me, it's not like obviously a parade in the middle of downtown you know, whatever. This is like when Prince Ali shows up and riding his elephant with his flamingos and his monkeys and, you know, his whole, like, just harem spreading wealth or whatever.
Absolutely. And that is very much the Jupiter vibe. It's a lot and so much. And, like, yeah, the grandiosity behind it. It's like, very signature Jupiterian vibe.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that that the brass is really kind of the star of this piece, and like the woodwinds are just kind of like playing that supporting role to the brass instruments. I think that certainly lends itself to that big feel, considering just in contrast to where we were at with Mercury and how, like, it was so heavy in the woodwinds and the string instruments. And now we're handing it over to the big guys.
Yeah. It's also kind of interesting. Like, Jupiter has, to me, it feels like, you know, three whole, like, pieces within just this piece, if you think about the different, like, sections and melodic themes, and we'll be coming up on the next one. With this clip, just as a little seed for all of us to be listening for, perhaps, even though this one is probably the biggest contrast to the other sections so far, it still has that constantly growing quality about it in a kind of unique way. But we'll talk about that on the other side of this. So, yeah, we've got this kind of lush chorale kind of section going on here, and as the melody keeps unfolding, if you keep listening, it's like it just keeps going higher. It never really resolves, and so it's kind of like this circular melody in some ways. So it's, even though it doesn't necessarily add a whole lot of other layers in terms of different counterpoints, it's just always moving on to the next thing. It doesn't really have a point of resolution.
Yeah, this was the moment when we listened to this before together. This was the one moment where you and I, like, differed in what we were feeling or what we experienced, where, like, I felt like there was a certain amount of fulfillment happening in this moment of this movement, that, like, you know, I was thinking about how joy can be experienced in all kinds of different ways, and there's something really comfortable about this part and how it almost felt kind of like coming home or something, that totally. Sort of, like, you know, sense of belonging or something. So, like, it was interesting, like, when you explain it musically and stuff, how, like, it never really truly gets resolved. It's kind of like roundabout or whatever, but, like, I didn't feel that way, like, emotionally, I guess.
Yeah, in the context of the piece, this is, like, the most homecoming sort of and, like, settled moment, for sure. So I think You're onto something there.
Yeah. Not way off base, I guess.
Let's see, what is next?
This piece feels so much like a Western adventure to me, or something.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and like a fun, weird Western adventure, like Wild Wild West, or like Shanghai Noon, or like Back to the Future 3, or something. Like,
oh my god, yes.
I don't know why, it just, musically I can't really explain what elements are popping up that make me think that, in terms of, like, pop culture references, but, it feels happy, it feels optimistic, it feels resolved, it feels like this crazy-ass Mardi Gras parade rolled into town, threw confetti all over the place and rolled out with the sunset, wailing on a trumpet.
Nailed it. Yeah, that is a big Jupiter vibe. And, this piece takes us a lot of places. Like, again, highly encourage y'all to listen to these things in their entirety, especially Jupiter, because it's got a lot of action to it, and it is a lot of fun throughout. And yeah, that last section was just kind of the wrapping things up after we've been around the block a few times and made a nice big mess. Time to book mm-hmm. it.
It is the roving band of dwarves that show up at your door at 8 p.m., ready to eat all your food and drink all your ale.
Yes, that's a good image. So, that is our first chunk of the planets, where you're going to take a little intermission, i.e. give you the next chunk in a separate episode, so this one isn't gargantuan.
Yeah, we just have a few more movements to discuss. We're going to be covering Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune next. And the overall vibe is going to get very different after this, folks. In the meantime, I am right there with Alice. I would definitely encourage you, if you haven't already, or if it's been a while maybe, to go back and listen to these pieces in their entirety. You know, it's worth it. It is worth the journey. It's worth the trip. It's not very long at all. I think you can listen to the entire suite in roughly 45-ish minutes.
Depending on how what tempo the conductor decided was Mars's right tempo.
Yes. And speaking of, we seem to agree that there is one superior version to listen to.
I mean, I always recommend Leonard Bernstein's recordings of the planets, just because astrological bias. I know, I'm pretty sure he's a Virgo, so it feels like this piece is in good hands given Holst's sun sign. But yeah, just avoid the Creative Commons version that's on Wikipedia.
hey, those kids did their best.
It's true. Yeah. It's true. It's
But yeah. Those the Leonard Bernstein versions, that can be found on Spotify. I will add the link to that particular composition to our show notes to make it that much easier. Jupiter in particular, for whatever reason, is the most popular song or movement in the entire suite. It's not my favorite, but I mean, I like it, but it's not my favorite.
It wasn't Holst's favorite either.
Well, see, there you go. What was Holst's favorite? Neptune?
Saturn.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And we can talk a little bit more about that in the next episode, including how Holst's charts may or may not have played into some of these things.
Yeah, okay. Neato bandito. So yeah, we'll cover Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune next time. I hope you are all looking forward to it. I hope you enjoyed this as much as I have. It's hard. It was actually harder for me this go around to just listen to snippets because I found myself knowing that there was more to be heard after each clip, and you know, like not being able to just let it play on and continue. It is genuinely one of those pieces where like I was vaguely, mildly aware of it prior to the podcast and you wanting to discuss it and feature it. But I have genuinely become fond of it. And the more I listen to it, the more I grow to love it. You know, I might as well just stop beating around the bush and just add that shit to my library on Spotify and just put it in the rotation because... I enjoy it, you know.
That makes me so happy to hear. it'll be fun to explore other pieces of music that have astrological themes, because I'm not that familiar with a lot of the pieces that I've just seen out and about. But, yeah, I mean, if I didn't have the opportunity to, or didn't have the effect of spreading astrological thoughts around because of how potentially useful they can be to people, I would at least, if I had to make the exchange, I would take spreading Holst's The Planets around if it were one over the other, just because, yeah, it is a powerful piece of music, in my opinion.
Yeah, and especially in the context of astrology, I mean, we maybe, probably would have featured it regardless, but it just makes so much sense to, you know, to feature it on our podcast and discuss, you know, some of the common traits and themes that take place for each of these planets, and why it's just kind of interesting that, I mean, this piece... or this suite is over 100 years old, and it still feels relevant. It's still influencing modern composers. Like, you would have to be, I don't know, like, living under a rock to not see how, like, common, or not commonplace, but, like, just how influential some of these movements have been on modern composers. Especially when it comes to like space themed soundtracks or, you know, just like sci-fi themed soundtracks, I guess, in general, there are moments where, I feel like I've heard, even in the pieces that we have talked about, where I feel like I've heard snippets of Star Wars or, Star Trek. There's, you know, all kinds of, like, how on earth did Holst, all those years ago, manage to create something that would be so relevant and so futuristic sounding that we're still enthralled with it today? It's amazing.
Yeah. Thanks, Holst.
You da bomb. You da bomb, Jeff Todd. Please tune in next time. We're going to be slingshotting the second part of this little feature at your ears and your faces pretty soon. And we just hope you keep listening. Thanks for joining us. You can follow us and like us. Please, oh, please, oh, please, on Facebook and Instagram, and shoot us an email at thegemandipodcast@gmail.com.
The Gemini Podcast is written and researched by both me and Alice. All of our sound production and editing is done by Alice Alistair, and all of our music, including our theme, comes from Uncertainty, Alice's one-of-a-kind solo act. Alice is also available for personalized natal chart readings. To learn more about availability and rates, reach out to us at thegemandipodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and stay curious, stargazers.